Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
We're here because Troy Bramson has put together a rather thick volume on Gough Whitlam's legacy. Gough Whitlam is a man who put his name on a cover and it's a bestseller. But it's an unusual volume. It's a range of opinions, reflections of people who were there and people who have looked back. So we're going to be an hour with our speakers and then a Q&A for half an hour. Troy Bramson will lead off. Troy is a contributing editor he's the contributing editor of the volume, The Whitlam Legacy, and also writes for The Australian, a columnist. And he'll be followed by Susan Ryan, as you all know Susan, former Labor Minister, Hawke Keating era, and now the Age Discrimination Commissioner, carrying well the issue and the cause. Gerard Henderson, John is going to come third. John Omani is a director at Deloitte Access Economics and a former senior economic advisor to the Julia Gillard and Rudd government, although to them personally, the Prime Ministers. And the last speaker will be Gerard Henderson, whom you all know is the executive director of the Sydney Institute and is about to go back after 20 years to the Australian as a columnist from the Sydney Morning Herald. So we'll get started with Troy, and each speaker will have about 15 minutes on Gough Whitlam's legacy, what worked, what didn't. Thank you, Troy.
Well, thanks very much, Anne, and thank you to Gerard and to Susan and John for also being here, and thank you all for coming. Well, it's great to be back at the Sydney Institute, one of the preeminent forums for public discussion and debate in Australia. I was born in the month after the dismissal of the Whitlam government in November 1975. My interest in politics and in public policy was sparked during the governments of Bob Hawke when I was at school and Paul Keating when I was at university. Hawke and Keating were the very model of a modern Labor government. And when Susan Ryan and I were compiling our edited book, The Hawke Government, A Critical Retrospective, she often told me there was no place for an unreconstructed Whitlamite in the Hawke government. For modern Labor, Whitlam was not to be emulated nor elevated to greatness, even though many true believers still yearned and still do yearn for a Whitlam-style government of energy, inspiration and reform. And I think the Whitlam government is impossible to ignore. How Whitlam rose through the ranks of the Labor Party to become leader, how the government came to power after 23 years in opposition, how it governed, what it achieved, where it failed, and of course, how it all ended. It remains an endlessly fascinating subject. It's the central reason why I decided to compile, contribute to, and edit this book. Frankly, it's time to bust the myths that percolate through the political discourse about Whitlam and his three-year government. Whitlam was not the worst Prime Minister Australia ever had. That honour must surely go to the hapless Billy McMahon. Nor did his government arrive in a burst of excitement and energy only to see its hopes dashed and its record marked by underachievement. I argue that the legacy extends to three key areas. First, the rebirth of Labor in the 1960s. Second, the way politics is practiced in the modern era. And third, to almost every area of public policy today. Let me explain each of these things. When Gough Whitlam took the helm of the Labor Party in 1967, it had suffered a string of defeats. The party was out of touch, it was unrepresentative, and it was unimaginative. Gough's crusade to reform the party, its structure and refresh its policies, saved it from electoral oblivion. If Gough did not wrest the leadership from Arthur Call in 1967, the party would have tolerated another election led by its ageing leader in 1969. Alternatively, the party could easily have chosen Kim Beazley Sr., Jim Cairns, Frank Crean, Fred Daly or Alan Fraser. Each of them would at some point seek to lead the Labor Party. But none of them would have led a crusade to reform the party, and it's doubtful whether they would have led Labor back to government. But if they did, it is also doubtful whether they would have implemented such a far-reaching program of reform against so much opposition. Indeed, there was nothing inevitable about a Whitlam-led Labor Party. He was seen by many in the party as an outsider, too ambitious, too impetuous, too overconfident. He was, as some said, not a Labor man. Yet he ascended to the leadership, he held it against the odds, and he saved the Labor Party. Hawke and Keating have both acknowledged that he paved the way for their eventual success in the 1980s and the 1990s. Secondly, Gough's emergence as a national political leader in the early 1960s, when he became deputy leader and then leader of the Labor Party, coincided with the dawn of modern politics, using television to its full potential, professionalised advertising, detailed market research, highly sophisticated campaigning. These tools are fundamental to success in politics today, and Whitlam and the party he led was the first to master them all. And third policy. On the evening of 13 November 1972, Gough Whitlam stood on the stage of the Blacktown Civic Centre. He looked out to an audience bursting with expectation, and he outlined the most sweeping policy manifesto ever presented to voters. No party had ever advocated such a broad plan for reform, nor has a party ever received a mandate to implement one. In contrast, Liberal Prime Minister Billy McMahon delivered his campaign speech seated behind a desk in a television studio with no audience. One journalist said that McMahon's speech would have encouraged a lot of housewives to take the opportunity to do the washing up while Dad put out the garbage bin and the milk bottles. Despite the turbulent 1,072 days of the Whitlam government and the hostility to the agenda it sought to implement, almost all of what was promised was achieved. Indeed, the policy legacy of the Whitlam government endures. Universal healthcare, needs-based schools funding, the reorientation of Australian foreign policy, including recognising China. The legal reforms are breathtakingly significant, lowering the voting age to 18, introducing territory senators, one vote, one value electoral laws, the abolition of the death penalty, no-fault divorce, legal aid, and removing the last vestiges of the White Australia policy from Australia's immigration laws. These policies and more are now part of the bipartisan policy settlement. But many of these policy shifts were vehemently opposed at the time. Others may look to the Whitlam government's complete withdrawal of forces from Vietnam, the abolition of conscription, the freeing of conscientious objectors, or the introduction of a new honours system, abolishing university fees, a new national anthem, the encouragement given to the arts, or simply sewering the suburbs. Although abolishing tariffs and reforming trade practices were important economic reforms, the failure to curb spending was a grave error of judgment. And we must acknowledge the scandals, the administrative chaos, the often poisonous caucus-cabinet relationship, and the relentless drive to implement a reform agenda, sometimes regardless the cost. But these things must not be allowed to obscure the landmark achievements. As Teddy White said about Franklin Roosevelt, he understood his times, and at the historic intersections, he took the fork in the road that proved to be correct. Now, there's no shortage of books about Gough Whitlam or the Whitlam government. As Gough said when he launched his own book in 1985, for a number of years, the Whitlam book industry was our largest growth industry after tax avoidance. Inevitably, though, accounts of the Whitlam government have focused more on its destruction than on what it delivered. Because of the focus on the dismissal rather than the breadth of the government's achievements and a frank assessment of its failures, I felt it was time to examine the Whitlam era in a new book. And I wanted to hear from the people who were there, ministers, staff, public servants and journalists, many who still had not told their story. And I wanted to balance these with academic contributions and those of contemporary commentators. The book is no whitewash. There are admirers, detractors, and impartial observers. Everything is covered, from policy and personalities to administration, the media, elections, and of course, the dismissal of the government on the November the 11th, 1975. Indeed, this book includes a number of revelations about the dismissal, which has often been a topic of discussion at the Sydney Institute over the past 25 years. So let me mention a few of these. Paul Kelly and I looked at Governor-General John Kerr's recently released papers in the National Archives some months ago. We drew some very sharply different conclusions to Jenny Hocking in her recent biography of Gough Whitlam. Her claim that John Kerr knew, quote, in advance, the response of the palace to the dismissal is not justified. In fact, the palace advised Kerr that they would accept his recall, which was his deepest fear, if Whitlam moved to have him sacked. It is this advice that led Kerr to plan his actions, as he said, quote, by stealth. Second, Hocking revealed the extent of the role of High Court Justice Anthony Mason in advising Kerr, and I stress extent of the role. Mason's role, of course, was known, but not indeed the extent of it. However, we discovered additional notes in Kerr's papers that reveal his constant need for reassurance and his reliance on the advice of Chief Justice Garfield Barwick and opposition frontbencher Bob Ellicott. Kerr also implicates another High Court judge, Ninian Stephen, with having prior knowledge of the dismissal. This was not mentioned by Hocking. Third, we found two notes written by Barwick, located in his files, which reveal previously undisclosed contact between the Governor-General and the Chief Justice. They reveal how Kerr advised Barwick on the letter he was to write, offering formal advice. And we reveal that they discussed how Whitlam should be handled on November 11 when hearing his commission had been terminated. When I discussed this with Malcolm Fraser in April this year, who was, of course, the ultimate beneficiary of the dismissal, he said, and I quote, "I think the Governor-General is properly entitled to ask for advice. Whether it is appropriate for the Chief Justice to give advice might be regarded as another thing, but that is for the Chief Justice." And then he said, "But for the Governor-General to suggest to the Chief Justice what should be in the letter, if he was going to write a letter, was totally inappropriate." He added that Kerr was, quote, "a lonely man who, quote, wanted reassurance for what he believed had to happen and was concerned about his place in history." And there's no question that Malcolm Fraser exploited all of those things. Fourth, Paul Kelly and I were given the first look at a transcript of John Kerr's 1970s oral history with the National Library. It shows that Kerr was repeatedly approached to become a Liberal MP. Indeed, he thought he could become Prime Minister. He flirted with the Democratic Labor Party. He idolised Garfield Barwick. And he thought deeply about the exercise of the reserve powers. And he had grown distrustful of Gough Whitlam. It underscores the obvious point that John Kerr was perhaps the single most unsuitable person in Australia that Gough Whitlam could have selected to be his Governor-General. Fifth, and we revealed that Solicitor General Maurice Byers and the head of the Attorney-General's Department, Clarence Hardis, had told John Kerr on November 11 and also a week later that the use of the reserve power was not justified. This worried Kerr. It worried Malcolm Fraser, and it threatened to unravel the dismissal in the afternoon of November 11. Finally, Kerr's draft statement of reasons for the dismissal is published in the book for the first time. It shows that Kerr wanted Fraser to accept, quote, "full political responsibility for the dismissal," perhaps implying that Fraser had prior knowledge, but these words were excised from the final version. I do think these revelations underscore also what Gough Whitlam said the dismissal always was, which was a coup conceived in secret and executed by ambush. Finally, let me say, it's been my privilege to meet and talk with Gough Whitlam many times over the past 20 years, including as recently as 2 weeks ago. On one visit in 2010, he told me that he would have resigned as Labor leader in the 1960s if his mission to reform the Labor Party had failed. He also told me that he had met Ben Chifley for the first time after he delivered the Light on the Hill speech at the Trades Hall in Sydney in 1949. The parallels are irresistible. The person who would follow Ben Chifley as the next Labor Prime Minister was seated in the audience when he delivered Labor's most famous speech. It is a story that has eluded biographers and historians. Now, there really is nobody like Gough Whitlam. He obviously sells books. He is, of course, larger than life. He combined courage, intellect and imagination as Prime Minister and party leader. As Robert Menzies told Jim Killen in the 1960s, that fellow Whitlam will lead the Labor Party one day and it won't be dull. And it wasn't dull. When he became Prime Minister, it often seemed like he was the government. It prompted one journalist to ask him, "Prime Minister, what would happen to the government if you fell under a bus tomorrow?" To which Whitlam replied, "With the improvements my government has made in urban transport, that is unlikely to happen." And of course, my favourite Gough story is when he was asked how he shall treat his maker when they eventually meet, Gough simply said, "I shall treat him as an equal." Today, Gough Whitlam is 97 years old. He's Australia's longest lived Prime Minister, and he can be found in his Sydney office a few days every week. He lives, of course, in a nursing home. He no longer consents to interviews, delivers orations or comments on politics. But in a foreword to this book, Gough offers what he says is his valedictory message to the party that he led in government and opposition for 11 years. He instructs Labor to learn the lessons of history, its achievements and its failures, and to apply these to developing policies that he says have a contemporary relevance for voters. But Gough's key message is to never forget the primacy of Parliament as the great forum for developing, presenting and articulating policy. Written during the final year of Julia Gillard's government, Whitlam's message contains a powerful truth that cannot be ignored. Now let me conclude by tackling one final myth. It is often argued that there was another way, that Whitlam's crash style was an indulgence that inevitably cost Labor power. But given the forces hostile to Whitlam's reform agenda, inside the Labor Party, among the Conservative parties, and in elements of the media, there really was no other way. Without Whitlam, it is doubtful whether Labor would have survived as a viable political force or that Australia would have been so profoundly remade. The Whitlam legacy endures because Gough Whitlam understood what politics is essentially about, and that is leadership. Thank you all for coming.
And now Susan Ryan.
Oh, well, good evening to supporters of the Sydney Institute and my fellow panellists. Thank you for giving the opportunity to come before you tonight as an unreconstructed Whitlamite. I was the one who constantly attracted that tag, and it wasn't a compliment, in the deliberations of the Hawke Cabinet. I suppose if I start with a little bit of my own, the beginning of my own relationship with Gough, you might understand that. I wasn't in the Whitlam government. I was first elected to the Senate in 1975 after the dismissal, which was not an auspicious time to start a political career, shall we say. It led to my forming, I suppose, a very dramatic idea of Whitlam. Because in that campaign, the 1975 campaign, and there will be some people in the room who remembered it, it was quite, the cliche rollercoaster doesn't come near to it. If I went around campaigning with Whitlam, to mass rallies in support of Wittliff, you would have thought, and I sort of did think, that we were going to be swept back into government. Such was the fervour, such was the sense of outrage, the fervour for Whitlam, the sense of outrage over the sacking and the dismissal. And, of course, there were so many groups in the community, including newly politicised women via the Women's Electoral Lobby, who really wanted Whitlam to be re-elected and thought he would. However, if you contrast those experiences with what actually happened on polling day, of course, it was terrible. It was a rout. So I still have that completely contradictory sense of the wonderful up moments of the campaign, particularly the candlelight rally outside Parliament House not long before the actual election date. I think Don Dunstan chaired it, another person that Labor people couldn't love more. And thousands of people turned up, lit candles, sang songs, and we thought, this is it. It's going to happen. Well, it didn't. So it was quite a dramatic time. And, of course, I was, in a sense, a beneficiary of the Whitlam Reform Program, which Troy has neatly summarised for us, particularly in the earlier part of his contribution, the creation of the Territory Senators. That was done by legislation. The Constitution provided for it, but it hadn't happened. And two senators' positions were created for the Northern Territory and the ACT, a law that was challenged in the High Court before the 1975 election, but it was upheld, and it was challenged afterwards. When I was in my very early days as a senator, our position was challenged, but again, the law was upheld. So it was just one of the interesting things that happened, and along with much of the Whitlam legislative program, if you step back from it, you can't imagine Australia as it would be without it. Not that everyone in this room would think that Territory Senators were, you know, an irreplaceable adornment to our national political landscape. But if you go to the Territories, they do. So, but also so many things that are now a part of our ongoing agenda, some of them very successfully implemented and re-implemented, such as Medicare, first Medibank, universal health insurance, such as needs-based funding of all schools, although, of course, we've all observed that we're having another go at that, another version of that. But that was started by Whitlam when he set up the Schools Commission and established very substantial needs-based funding of all schools in Australia. The removal of university fees was not maintained as a policy, even though as Education Minister I fought a few battles. I lost the war on that one. However, access to university for those with the ability and the motivation to go is still a very important and growing. Access to universities is growing. So these things, and not to mention the questions of Aboriginals and their relationship to the land that they occupied before we came, these things are still huge things on our national agenda. And, of course, who could imagine an Australia in which we didn't have an important, perhaps the crucially important, trading relationship with China? And yet when Whitlam visited China as leader of the opposition in 72, it was seen as an outrageous act of, well, it proved that he was a communist, really, didn't it? It was seen, but happily, Whitlam wasn't a person who had a lot of luck in politics, but happily that early visit to China turned out to be very lucky timing, because it emerged that Henry Kissinger was there at the same time, paving the way for a visit from Nixon. So what was going to be presented by the enemies of Whitlam as an outrageous pro-communist act actually became a sensible global strategic move that the President of the United States immediately gave credit to. So all of those things really that happened because of Whitlam and have been developed and, as I said, changed a bit, maybe not changed, some resolved, some not resolved. You really couldn't imagine modern Australia without them. But I would like to go to the policy area, which is the subject of my chapter in the book, and that's women. Now, when Whitlam was elected in 1972, there was not one woman elected to the Federal Parliamentary Labor Party. not one. There had been a woman in the past, Senator Dorothy Tangney from Western Australia. She'd been elected in 43, she lost her seat in 67. There had not been any other Labor woman. So, I mean, that, and that really, I think, demonstrated where women were in Australian public life or Australian economic life. I think by that stage there might have been one woman appointed judge. Had Roma Mitchell been appointed a judge? Maybe not, maybe shortly after. She had been appointed by then. But, I mean, as to a woman on the High Court, that was simply, you know, no one, even we very ambitious young feminists, never even envisaged something like that. There was no woman vice chancellor of a university. There had maybe been one or two female professors in our universities. There were no women current affairs journalists, basically. Women were not allowed to appear on television except on what was called women's programs. And women weren't even allowed to be on radio because the sound of a woman's voice would be irritating and would lack authority. So when you think, and of course, even in enrolments of university students, women, female students were a very small minority. So if we go from there till now, where women have leading roles in all major institutions, professions, occupations in Australia, not enough, some of you will hasten to add, and I agree with that, but we have had a female Prime Minister, we have a female Governor General, we've had several female premiers now. We've had several female state governors, and indeed we enjoy the governorship of Professor Bashir still at this moment. So those changes are really huge when you think that they hadn't started when I first entered Parliament. So perhaps you could understand why I am the unreconstructed Whitlamite, because I saw his initiatives in policies that affected women as being the beginning of what I'm very pleased to call a social revolution. And it was also interesting that he was prepared to support such a range of initiatives that assisted opportunities for women. Because at that time, not only was there no woman in his caucus, but there had been virtually no women in the upper echelons of the party machine and virtually no women in senior positions in the trade union movement. Whitlam, of course, spent years preparing policy for the time that he became Prime Minister. And that long, detailed preparation of policy in the areas of foreign policy, defence, the development of cities, the development of suburbs, the environment, very early policy work in the environment, Aboriginal land rights, all of that work had been going on for years before he actually got the chance to implement it, which is why his It's Time speech at Blacktown was, as you say, such a detailed manifesto. He hadn't, of course, prepared a very detailed manifesto on opportunities for women, because basically there were no women in the organisations he was involved with to make proposals. However, there had been, by that stage, quite a long tradition of supporting equal pay in industrial matters, not achieved, but it was certainly an aspiration. And one of the first things he did as Prime Minister was to reopen the equal pay case and appoint Mary Gaudron, a name that might have become very familiar to you, as the legal advisor for the equal pay case. But he also did something that at the time seemed extremely eccentric and even, you know, a bit embarrassing, which was he took the sales tax off the oral contraceptive. Now, some of you in this room might think, well, that's pretty small beer. But in fact, it wasn't, because there was a huge problem at that time with women's access to reproductive knowledge and control. There had been no abortion law reform at all, and access to contraception was very limited. The contraceptive pill was available, but on prescription from the doctor only, and often only to married women, and it was very expensive. So by taking that measure to reduce the sales tax, it meant that women without a lot of means could start having some control over their own reproduction as more affluent or knowledgeable women had. But he also did what was seen as a radical and indeed high-risk thing, and he appointed a women's advisor, and that was Elizabeth Reed. I don't know whether, has Elizabeth ever spoken at the Institute? Elizabeth was a philosopher, Oxford-trained, although she'd been to the ANU also, and a feminist, and she was appointed to go into his prime ministerial office to advise him about women. Well, I can tell you that caused uproar, especially in the media. She was to be paid at what was the level of sort of a middle-ranking public servant. The job was filled by an open advertisement, and there were a number of applicants, and five of us were shortlisted. I was one. The media then ran round after us taking photos of us and calling us goth supergirls. But the worst thing was that this, I think $8,000 comes to my mind, but it was about what a, as I said, middle-level public servant you would get. Why would any woman be paid that to talk about women's affairs? Well, it was a high-risk move and a very contentious one, but it also opened the floodgates because women at last had someone they could write to about their problems, their marital problems, domestic violence, about discrimination in the workforce, lack of childcare, all of those things. There was an absolute deluge of submissions from women that Whitlam attempted to address and started to address, you know, with childcare programs. He funded the first women's refuges. He funded the first women's health centres. All of this now sounds pretty well, you know, that's what governments do, but all of it was extremely contentious. So he didn't, and he didn't step back from any of that. And that's why so many women of my era and older today still hold him in extraordinarily high regard, because as his government was getting into the stormy weather that Troy has outlined for us, and all sorts of things were going wrong, and some of them were big mistakes of the Whitlam government, at the same time there was this constant sarcasm and derision about his efforts to improve opportunities for women. He never flinched. He just kept doing it. And even in 1975, it was to be the first United Nations International Women's Year. He appointed a committee to develop projects for the International Women's Year, and he funded that committee to the tune of $2 million. $2 million. Well, the media went berserk about that. $2 million, there are all sorts of jokes about what are they being paid for and so on and so forth. And he also sent a delegation to that first international UN meeting in Mexico City. I was lucky enough to be on that. And it was quite clear when we were there, and Elizabeth Reed gave to the world a description of the improvements for women's lives that the Whitlam government had been undertaking, that we were world leaders. It was marvellous. I mean, for years after that, people would come to Australia to examine all these policies and to ask us how such policy initiatives came about. So I think for a leader who'd come through all of the struggles, all of the internal dramas and scandals of quite a fragmented labour movement for quite a lot of the time when he was developing his leadership, to suddenly become this world leader on policies to advance the circumstances of women was really outstanding. Did him no good at the ballot box whatsoever. We came back from the high of being in Mexico City and being world leaders in this sort of policy. I think we got news of the Bass by-election on the way back. And, of course, we came back to the shocking defeat. And it seemed that all of those policy initiatives would be thrown up with the Whitlam government. But they weren't. They weren't. And the important thing about policy, and I guess, Troy, you say the greatest thing is leadership. I've got policy and leadership together. The soundly identified policies, I'm not saying they're all soundly implemented, but the soundly identified policies to achieve social progress in Australia that started with Whitlam have never been dismantled. And it's my own personal test of good policy. What is good policy? Good policy meets a very serious, well-defined need, and good policy survives over the decades. And Whitlam's policies for women did. How are we going, Tom? So, as I said, it's time for the unreconstructed Whitlamite to move over and give John his turn. Thank you.
John O'Marney with an Economic View.
Good evening, everyone. My chapter in Troy's book is Economic Policy. I think if the editor had provided me with a longer title, it might have been Whitlam Government Economic Policy Comedy, Tragedy, or a little bit of both. I celebrated my 34th birthday yesterday. I don't mention that to encourage you all to sing, happy birthday, but to put in perspective that I wasn't born at the time when the Whitlam government was elected or when it was dismissed. And I'd even have a fair crack at being the youngest person in the room. But what I wanted to bring to the analysis for the book was a perspective of someone who worked for Kim Beazley, for Kevin Rudd, and for Julia Gillard as a senior economic advisor and someone with experience in helping to make economic election commitments and see them being taken over by elections inside government despite all the will in the world. And I think there's a fair bit of that in the Whitlam government story as well. The trick with an exercise like this is not just to focus on what happened or try to answer a question of whether the Whitlam government was a good economic manager or not, because in many ways, as Graham Freudenberg has said, you know, the facts haven't changed since 1975 and they're not going to change now. And instead to try to focus on the higher level questions of economic management under the Whitlam government, how does it look with the benefit of 40 years difference? How does it look with the benefit of what we know about the economy since? What was the Whitlam government's economic legacy for Australia? So, because the chapter isn't a murder mystery, I don't mind giving you my punchline from it, which would be something like this, that with the benefit of 40 years hindsight, the Whitlam government economic legacy looks marginally better than what it felt at the time, and despite having some positive economic legacies, for the most part, the main legacy of the Whitlam government is the lessons learned from its mistakes. And the chapter is largely not a defence of the Whitlam government's economic legacy. It would be described as mildly corrective of people's experiences. If you allow me one more thespian reference, just because it is a Gough talk, I think if the Gough Whitlam economic legacy was a story, a play with three acts, they would be called Struggle, Floundering and Rehabilitation. But in many ways, the Whitlam government economic story does not start in 1972. It doesn't start when the government's elected. It starts before that, and that is the government, the economy that the government inherits. I was horrified at how much I had to understand the 1950s and 1960s Australian economy in order to understand just what was happening at that important early 1970s period, which, of course, is a very important inflection point in Australia's economic history. By 1972, the Australian economy is uncompetitive. It has low rates of economic growth. It's a closed economy compared with the international economy that we have today. It's an economy with a fixed exchange rate. It's an economy with a lot of structural weaknesses, powerful unions, uncompetitive businesses. And by the time the Whitlam government is elected, inflation, on the day it's elected, is already running at 7% per year, which is, you know, three times what the inflation rate would be today. And it is to say that in some respects, the economy was already past that tipping point. And according to some economists, it was too late to be addressing some of the structural challenges that were already embedded inside the economy that Whitlam inherited. Whitlam came to power and the government came to power with a significant economic agenda. And it isn't right to say, as people might think with 40 years hindsight, that it was a government without an economic agenda. From the It's Time speech Troy quoted earlier. Gough Whitlam, I won't do the impersonation. Will you again entrust the nation's economy to the men who deliberately but needlessly created Australia's worst unemployment for 10 years, or to the same men who have presided over the worst inflation for 20 years? The whole period of the McMahon government has been marked by the lowest rate of growth experienced in Australia since the 1930s and one of the lowest in the developed world, a paltry 3% a year. And in the policy speech that Troy mentioned, there is an ambitious economic agenda announced. Just consider these promises. A target for economic growth of 7% a year. That is double what the economic growth target is for Australia at the moment. Full employment, lowering inflation through a prices justification tribunal, and a series of what would now be called microeconomic reforms, changes to trade practices law, competition policy, national development, and a plan to pay for it with bracket creep, which in budget terms means not indexing the personal income tax scales so that tax goes up over time so it can be funded in the budget. It comes to government with a significant economic agenda, and Act One is primarily the fight against inflation. In that first year, there's the revaluation of the exchange rate. That is, putting up the value of the exchange rate to reduce inflationary pressures in Australia. And that, of course, happens against the significant agricultural political interests in Australia. Cutting tariffs on imported goods by 25% in that first period. Scrapping the tariff board, setting up an industries assistance commission, all to help reduce inflation. And they also set up something called the Prices Justification Tribunal, Whitlam's argument that they can reduce price pressures across the economy using an economic tool now that wouldn't pass the laugh test called moral suasion. Moral suasion. That was the economic lever of the time to try to convince businesses not to raise prices. And yet, for all the humour in an economic lever like that, it was but 10 years later when the Labor government, the next Labor government, the Hawke-Keating Labor government, was able to use its relationship with the trade union movement through the Accord to lower organised Labor's wage demands in the economy. Effectively, a version of moral suasion to try to tackle inflation in Australia. But back to 1973, there is a wages policy frames to drive inflation inside the economy. In 1973, the government supports an overnight increase in the minimum wage of 30%. It supports a government policy of encouraging excessive wage demands inside the public sector precisely so that it can be a pace setter for the private sector. Active government policy to raise wages across the economy, and in later years, allowing sweetheart deals between powerful unions, big businesses to drive wages through the economy. And it's what Whitlam himself later describes as his chief economic failure over that period, and that is letting wages get out of control. Later that year, there's the first budget, which implements the government's election commitments, pays for them with tax increases and other spending changes, but does not do enough to tackle inflation. That is, it's not contractionary enough. The deficit is too big. That's the first year. And for the most part, you'd say that the government was on track for that period. But then it enters a period of dramatic economic turmoil, some of it Australian, some of it overseas. It's the floundering period from late 1973 to early 1975, that long year. We're in a relatively short period of time. The government has to deal with the collapse of the Bretton Woods fixed exchange rate system, inflation being exported from the United States, a quadrupling of oil prices, the collapse of international stock markets, industrial action around the world, major recession in the United States and the United Kingdom, alongside the commodity boom that's already causing domestic economic challenges. There is now international economic chaos. And you know, if an economist was explaining the last 50 years of economic history, what they would say about that early 1970s period is it was an inflection point. It was the period where we moved from the long boom following the post-Second World War era through to the modern era of higher rates of inflation and unemployment, where there was a major change in how we saw how the economy fit together and how it worked. The Whitlam government was sitting there with the same economic levers that had been working with moderate effectiveness in the 1950s and 1960s, and it was trying to pull these levers, and they weren't being effective. And you see all of the policy roundabouts over that 1974 period. The government increasing beer and cigarette taxes, proposing a company tax for businesses that increase wages too much, and then not implementing it, a credit squeeze, and then devaluing the currency, which are policy levers in different directions, reintroducing import quotas, announcing a capital gains tax, announcing they weren't going to proceed with a capital gains tax, additional funding for the states. And then in the middle, they have this horror budget of runaway spending, where government spending increases by 50% in just 1 year. The treasurer at the time is Frank Crean, who's been there the first 2 years, and he proposes a contractionary budget to settle the economy down. But the caucus economics committee chairman, Jim Cairns, leads a caucus revolt, saying with an economy in recession, we should be stimulating the economy. So they have this stimulatory budget that the treasurer delivers and then privately describes as this, a quote from our book. Not in the papers before. I believe that the impact of the... This is the treasurer of the day speaking. I believe that the impact of the 1974-75 budget, as framed, will be grossly inflationary. I must state my sad conviction that we have opted for what is likely to give us the worst of all worlds. The result is likely to be a vicious circle of spiralling inflation, depressed employment and activity, the classic stagflation situation. If there was a low point in Whitlam government economic management, that would be towards the end of 1974. And yet, during that period, we also see the introduction of the Trade Practices Act, changes to business practices, which make it more difficult for business to increase prices and are important reform. But they're no elixir for inflation in the short term. And then the third act is the rehabilitation of the Whitlam government's economic legacy somewhat in 1975. As Whitlam's economic advisor Fred Gruen later said, the public perception of an incompetent government lurching from crisis to crisis is based on a period of about one-third of the length of this time in government, both before the 1974 election and after Hayden and McClelland, that's Bill Hayden becomes Treasurer, Jim McClelland becomes the Labor Minister, were appointed Treasurer and Minister for Labor respectively. A reasonably credible case can be made that the government's handling of economic affairs. And in that last year, they introduced wage indexation, linking wage increases to inflation, which these days would be considered to be very contributing to inflation, but at the time was a way of trying to settle inflation down. They set up the Expenditure Review Committee, that is a razor gang to try to cut government spending, but there's still an increase in the budget deficit. What I found fascinating going back through the Cabinet papers was this finding that Bill Hayden, the Treasurer at the time, came forward to Cabinet in 1975 with a submission to reintroduce university fees for students. Now, that was knocked on the head by the rest of Cabinet, it didn't happen, but it was to say that even by the end of the Whitlam government, there were already questioning of some of those commitments. So to make a couple of observations about its assessment and legacy, if you were to just look at the economic indicators, economic growth and unemployment in Australia during the Whitlam period are relatively strong compared with other countries overseas. But inflation is much worse, and that largely reflects the failings in managing industrial relations and in managing the budget during that period. Over the Whitlam government, there are substantial progress made in what would now be called microeconomic reform, or if you've been watching the the Paul Keating interviews on ABC the last few Tuesdays, all that stuff that Paul Keating was responsible for. If you listen to his side of the story for the world according to Paul, there are a few down payments on microeconomic reform that are made during the Whitlam government. In particular, by cutting tariffs, by getting rid of the tariff board, by introducing trade practices reform, and by moving the exchange rate more in line with market movements, it does make the economy more flexible. It does make businesses more responsive to what consumers want and less able to be only doing what powerful unions want. And that is an important starting point for microeconomic reform in Australia. But I think it's fair to say that for the most part, it is the government's challenges in wages policy and in budgetary policy that for the most part influence the Hawke-Keating economic legacy, which is firstly the accord with the union movement, and secondly the budget trilogy, which is to achieve budget surpluses, not increase taxes, not increase government spending, to try to better use fiscal policy to manage the economy. And just one final point about the post-Hawke and Keating period. It's fair to say that from 1996, the Hawke and Keating economic legacy is far more significant than the Whitlam government economic legacy for Labor. During that late 90s period and early 2000s period, it's primarily trying to live down the recession of the early 1990s, and Labor is trying to rebuild its economic credibility from the budget deficits of the mid-1990s. No one in late 1990s or early 2000s that I can recall in Labor was standing around saying, oh, but we've got to think about what Whitlam did to the economy or live down this or emulate that. And I think the same is true for Kevin Rudd as Prime Minister and as opposition leader, that while Whitlam's name was regularly invoked as an aspirational bar for reform and social change, I don't recall Whitlam government economic policies ever being a legacy to live up to or a nightmare not to be relived as it might have been in previous periods. But as some of these things recede into history, it's likely that the economic legacy of the Whitlam government will merge together with the other governments, the Hawke-Keating, the Rudd-Gillard governments, and Labor governments of the future, for one overall narrative. So, thank you very much.
Thanks. Well, I'm a great admirer of Susan Ryan, and we differ just a little bit. But not a whole lot. I mean, she's an unreconstructed Whitlamite, and I'm unreconstructed, but I'm not a Whitlamite, so we've got certain similarities here. I was asked in the book by Troy to comment on the Whitlam government from the vantage point of the opposition, which I have done, and I'm going to talk mainly about the opposition. I went to work in Canberra in January 1976. Anne and I had gone down to Launceston at the beginning of that year, where I was working for Kevin Newman, the member for Bass, and started off as the Minister for Repatriation. He got a few promotions beyond that. Kevin's not often talked about these days. About 10 years ago, he's best known as Jocelyn Newman's husband, and now he's best known as Campbell Newman's father. But I knew him as Kevin Newman, or Ollie, as they used to call him. And I was very grateful he gave me a job when others didn't. So I've always looked... Kevin died recently, or not some years ago, but I've always looked very fondly on my time down there. Now, I'm not going to talk much about Labor because some of it's in my paper. John gave me a copy of his paper probably a couple of years ago, and he's just spoken about it now, and I think it's a very significant essay. I think from a social democratic perspective, I think perhaps the most important assessment of the Whitlam government, because I noticed when I got to Canberra how the lesson of the Whitlam government from the time that Bill Hayden became the opposition leader after Whitlam's second defeat in 1977, the real impact of the Whitlam government was not to be like Gough Whitlam. And if you read and listen to the works of Paul Keating and Bob Hawke and Bill Hayden and Peter Walsh, and some others. I mean, what they were trying to demonstrate, that Labour could be a modern, reformist, efficient administrative a government that could run the country, and that came to pass under the governments of Hawke and Keating, which, as a commentator, I supported by and large. I think were extremely good governments, as I think also the government of Howard and Peter Costello was an extremely good government. I think, however, people like Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard, being of a different political generation, took a different message. I mean, Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard would forever say that without Gough Whitlam they wouldn't have gone to university. I mean, it's complete nonsense. There was a Commonwealth Scholarship scheme introduced by Robert Menzies in 1951. Bright people like Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard would have won scholarships. They would have got all their fees paid plus a very generous means-tested allowance. It's also important to bear in mind that the largesse of free university education was not abolished by Malcolm Fraser but by the Hawke Keating government because it was too expensive. Now, I'll talk a bit about my time. I didn't work in the opposition during Malcolm Fraser's time as opposition leader, or before that Billy Snedden, but I was close to Tony Staley at the time, who was close to Malcolm Fraser. I did meet Malcolm Fraser and I had been observing the Liberal Party. What I thought I'd talk about was probably three, because I'm trying to keep it brief, three personalities who I think are worth remembering because they were very strong figures. Bert Kelly, the rather quaint Liberal Party member for Wakefield, who was a minister briefly in the final years of the coalition government before the election of the Whitlam government, was one of these people who had a great deal of sense and strength and intellectual conviction. And at a time when the Liberals were very weak, Bert was very strong and always very witty. And in the mayhem that John has described so well, which focused on 1974, the economic mayhem commenced a bit before then, finished a bit after, but mainly focused on 1974. And soon after Malcolm Fraser became Liberal Party leader in March 1975, Bert Kelly was given the opportunity to ask a question in the Parliament, and he asked what I think is perhaps the most significant question that's ever been asked in the Australian House of Representatives, and it was addressed to the left-wing hero of the day, Jim Cairns, who was then the Treasurer. And Bert read out this question, which was as follows. My question is directed to the Treasurer. Last week, the Treasurer, Jim Cairns, told us about his policy of using deficit financing to lower the present level of unemployment. How is his solution of burying the unemployment problem under a mountain of money actually working out? If printing money is a good solution to the unemployment problem, why not print more of the stuff and get rid of unemployment problem altogether? A brilliant question, to which Jim Cairns answered, we might do precisely that. And from that moment, Cairns's career was finished. His biographer acknowledges that was the reason why he got dismissed. And it just stated what was the problem of the Whitlam government, where the Treasurer would fall for that sort of Bert Kelly question. Some years later, Bert asked a question of John Howard when he was Treasurer in the Fraser government after a New Zealand horse had won the Melbourne Cup, and Bert got up and said, can we bring in more protection? We've got to stop these foreign imports taking all our cups away. And John Howard, unlike Jim Cairns, picked it. But Jim Cairns didn't. I thought I'd talk briefly about Malcolm Fraser, who I've known on and off for quite some time. I was one of the few commentators in Australia who predicted on the 1st of December 2009, when Tony Abbott became Liberal leader, that he would be a real threat to Labor and a real threat to Kevin Rudd, which turned out to be. And I did so because I could notice historically that the Liberal leaders who won against incumbent Labor governments were hard, tough, negative politicians where they had to be negative, who cut through. And I had in mind Robert Menzies in 49, Malcolm Fraser in 75, John Howard in 1996, and so it came to pass. Later, Tony Abbott. Now, in his book, Malcolm Fraser, The Political Memoirs, which I've written about in the Sydney Issue Quarterly and my Sydney Morning Herald column and elsewhere, at the end of it, Malcolm Fraser says that he has a memory which is, quote, notoriously fallible. And it is also said, because it's co-authored, but it's written in the third person, that these days Malcolm Fraser is appreciated by the same kinds of people who once reviled him for his role in the dismissal of the Whitlam government, and he gets standing ovations at literary festivals, which doesn't surprise me. But what I thought I'd talk a bit about what Fraser was really like. And this is what, and I mentioned this in the book, Fraser in 1975 was not the hand-holding, soft type who was welcomed by the bicycle-riding, sandal-wearing attendees at literary festivals. Fraser was a ruthless, negative opposition leader who rolled his leader, Billy Snedden, in March 1975 and who destroyed the Whitlam government 8 months later. It is true that in the first half of the 70s he was sympathetic to asylum seekers and supportive of immigration, concerned about the plight of Indigenous Australians along with the environment. That is true. But he was also a strong supporter of the Australian-American Alliance, who was a deeply anti-communist. He advocated Israel's right to exist within secure boundaries. He spoke out against terrorism. He was, in the terminology of the day, an ardent Cold War warrior, which is why I supported him, I'd have to say. And he didn't have the kind of worldview which would get standing ovations at the then equivalents of literary festivals, which would be something or other that was funded by the taxpayer with someone else paying, where you exhibited your own self-righteousness and demonstrated it was higher than everyone else's present. Also, Fraser was a vehement opponent of China and accused Whitlam of being an agent of the Chinese in a letter he wrote to The Age of all places, and in those days they published it. That was before The Age became The Guardian on the Arab. And I should make one other point. For those who think that Whitlam opened Australia up to China, I'd have to remind Susan Ryan that throughout the 50s and the 60s, we exported wheat to China. The wheat board exported wheat to China. I happen to know this because Bob Santamaria campaigned against it at the time. But he couldn't prevail over the Liberal government, so there you go. Now, I thought I'd talk a little bit about John Kerr, because I like social lepers, so when Kerr was down and out, no one would talk to him. I'd go around there. There was a group of us. There was Laurie Short, the former trade union official, Kenneth Gee, the former judge, John Paul, the academic, and myself, social lepers all. And when John Kerr couldn't find anyone else to go to lunch with, he used to invite us around. So I got to know him quite well. We had individual lunches. We never sort of caucused together, but we had individual lunches, and they were most enjoyable. But I got to understand him pretty well. Now, so when Troy Bramson asked me to get into this book, I was very grateful. I'm a great admirer of Troy's work. I think for a man of his generation or a woman of his generation, he's one of the few people who's obsessed about facts and quite neurotic and pedantic. I think we share a lot in common in that regard. And he also railed against the ABC's documentary, Whitlam, The Power and the Passion. I also criticised it in my column, and demonstrated a huge number of absolute historical howlers, which is now common in most ABC documentaries. I thought you'd like to know this because you're paying for them. And when I complained against one of them, I got a note from a Mr. Phil Craig, who signs off as ABC head of factual. And what he defended the documentary on the basis that it told what he called a lyrical truth. So there you are, the ABC head of factual is in fact the ABC head of lyrical. So it just shows you where we're all going. But I do disagree with Troy on one incident. I just thought I'd talk a bit about the dismissal. And here we go back to Malcolm Fraser's memory. What I found contemptible about Malcolm Fraser is that, having initiated the dismissal, because he blocked supply and was determined to block supply, and Gough Whitlam was determined to govern without supply, and someone had to resolve the mess, and it was the Governor-General, which wasn't a nice place to be in. But Kerr did what had to be done because the matter had to be resolved. As Troy Bramson has just quoted, Fraser, nearly 40 years after the event, now criticises Kerr, or is still criticising Kerr's actions, from which he was one of the principal beneficiaries. He in terms of the fact that he got two offers, Whitlam in terms of the fact that it helped his legacy. Now, and Kerr ends up having lunch with me, so you can work out who the loser was. Now, I understand that some people don't have good memories, that I forget what it's like not to have a good memory, but I do understand it. But the point I make is this, and I accept that Malcolm Fraser has a bad memory, I accept that. But I do make this point, that in order to believe Malcolm Fraser from what he told his biographer Philip Ayres, or what he's written with Margaret Simons, the academic, the journalistic lecturer, who is associated with all these howlers, and what he's told Troy Bramson about what happened on the 11th of November 1975, you have to disbelieve everything he said before then. Because Malcolm Fraser always said that he had no prior knowledge from Kerr that Whitlam was going to be sacked. But from the mid-1980s, a decade after the event, based only on his own memory, he changed that and said that he did know. I believe completely that Malcolm Fraser is telling the truth, but I'm concerned about his memory. And it is now based on the fact that he says that he was tipped off by Kerr at 9:55 a.m. on the morning of the 11th of November, and there is this document where Kerr set him out the arrangements that would apply to the caretaker government. And here it is. It's in page 425 of Troy's book. And there the provisions up the front and the date down the bottom. But what is very clear to me is that the handwriting and the style of writing up the top is dramatically different from the date and the timing down the bottom. And I have a feeling that this was dated well after the event and that Malcolm Fraser forgot when he dated it. I mean, this is a serious point. Because what Kerr always said was that these caretaker arrangements were given to Mr. Fraser when he attended Government House after the dismissal of the Whitlam government, which Fraser originally said was true, but now Fraser said he was told before the dismissal of Whitlam government when he was in the Parliament House. But you've only got to look at that in Troy's book, and there's got some great documents in Troy's book to see that there is some kind of problem. There also Sir David Smith, who spoke to Kerr immediately after, says this didn't happen. Bob Ellicott, who was in the room when Fraser took the call from Kerr, says it didn't happen, there wasn't time. This is pretty powerful evidence. David Smith and Bob Ellicott do have very good memories, as is being demonstrated. So I just thought I'd say one point about that, about John Kerr. And I thought I would make... And the reason why Fraser says it is... Fraser now says is that he had to tell Kerr what he was going to... Fraser says that Kerr had to tell him what he was going to do because if he dismissed the Whitlam government and Fraser refused to take the provisions of the caretaker arrangement, Kerr would have been left without a prime minister. Well, that's a bit much because Fraser had started to block supply around the 16th of October. I lived through it. I followed it. Fraser was determined. Fraser was insistent. Fraser was resolute, and he had all his party with him. The idea that people were going to cross the floor in the Senate is a complete myth. He had them with him. And the idea that Kerr would have thought that he would dismiss Whitlam, have Fraser out at Yarralumla and say to Mr. Fraser, will you accept to become Prime Minister? And Fraser said, no, not really. I don't agree. I mean, this is just insane. This is just couldn't possibly happen. And Kerr said it didn't happen, and why would it happen? Fraser wanted to bring down Whitlam. He brought down Whitlam, and having brought down Whitlam, he would have accepted any terms. And he did accept all the terms. I mean, there weren't very much in them anyway, though, but what we now call the basic caretaker terms. I just want to make one final point about Sir Garfield Barwick, who I met and interviewed for my book Menzies Child, and Justice Anthony Mason, who I know and who has addressed the Sydney Institute. Now, I want to be fair to them, and I'm going to be fair to them by quoting the work of Professor Anne Toomey. Now, it is true that John Kerr had discussions with Sir Garfield Barwick before the dismissal, and that was known at the time of the dismissal. I was the first person to write about and document that he had discussions with Anthony Mason because Kerr told me, and once the story was coming out, I thought it was appropriate to do. And I wrote a column in the Sydney Morning Herald, and I sent a copy to Sir Anthony before it came out just to make sure it didn't contain any factual error. So I checked my facts. And there were later developments in Jenny Hocking's book, and Troy Bramson has corrected some of them in the very interesting chapter he's done with Paul Kelly in this book, and I think the general material in this book on the dismissal is quite fair. I disagree with some of the interpretations, but it's well worth reading. Now, the suggestion is that such contact between a Governor-General and members of the judiciary was and is improper, and now Malcolm Fraser's going along with all this. But Professor Toomey, in an article in a 2012 issue of Public Law Review, says that prior to 1975, I mean prior to this matter becoming a big controversial issue, quote, advice to vice-regal officers from judges can hardly be described as unprecedented, unusual, or unconventional. And in relation to the detailed revelation concerning Sir Anthony Mason, Professor Toomey writes, quote, in the context of the time, his, Anthony Mason's, actions were not inconsistent with those of his predecessors or his colleagues. And this was true at the federal level in regards to governors general and at the state level in regard to state governors. This was very common right through Australian history from the turn of the century to the middle of the 1970s. And you should, it's worth having a look at Professor Toomey's paper. So I'm just going to conclude by saying this, that in the lead up to the dismissal, Kerr exhibited great strength. In the difficult days in opposition and the terrible days of Billy Snedden, he was a complete lightweight. Bert Kelly exhibited great strength. And at the time, when he had to do what he thought he had to do, Malcolm Fraser also exhibited great strength. And Gough Whitlam resisted with great strength. And it was a great time to be around, and I'm very pleased that, that Troy and his colleagues have documented more of this story in the Whitlam legacy. Thank you.
Well done. We nearly made it on time. We only have 20 minutes for questions, and I'd like to thank Mallisons for the use of this lovely room with a perfect view outside, which you're not allowed to look at. We've got probably time for a few questions before the top of the hour. Kieran, maybe you start off. Now, we haven't got roving mics, so speak up. And the four of you, what do you suggest? Come along to the microphone?
Yes.
Is it to anyone in particular or to everyone?
Well, no, not really. I just wanted to direct the possibility to John Oden.
Okay, come on.
He admitted he wasn't alive at the time. We were talking about, I was managing a business from 74 through to 76, so I just want to give you that perspective, and I can tell you for an absolute fact, John, that Gough Whitlam left the Australian economy in a state of inflationary ruin. He was an economic incompetent. But the topic this afternoon is Gough Whitlam's legacy. Legacy, what did he do? What he did was he changed the relationship between government and the electorate in Australia. And he was the first to say, you can have it all. You want free education? Yep, doesn't matter if we can't afford it. You want free Medicare? Doesn't matter if we can't afford it.
So you asking, did he do that?
No, I'm saying he did.
Okay, what's the question?
What I would like to know is, to what extent did those, that next batch of economic incompetence, the Rudd, Gillard, Swan's government, who in fact did look back to Hawke and Keating, they in fact looked back to that earlier era and must have had Gough on the pedestal, because Swan admitted he couldn't balance his own personal checkbook.
Okay.
And with record terms of trade,
we
record
got
low interest rates, I'm nearly finished, record low unemployment, he could deliver a budget surplus. So
okay.
Do you think,
John,
the legacy of the Whitlam government was the devil's spawn, if you like, was the Rudd Gillard government?
Maybe you were there.
Just on your first point, I think one interesting observation from afar is that the expanded offering of government that Whitlam first brought to Australia was subsequently found to be sustainable. Not all of it. There were many things like abolishing the means test on the assets test on the age pension, which didn't survive. Free education didn't survive. But there were many parts of the government expansion that were sustainable. They were made sustainable in the future through higher rates of taxation. And if you were to compare the size of government with between 1972 and 1982, 1992, 2002, 2012, most of that expansion in government hasn't been wound back. And that is the public's appetite for an expanded government offering of health and education, these things, has largely been satisfied and has been paid for through higher taxation. And it hasn't been wound back. But at the time, the expansion happens too quickly and it has macroeconomic consequences that are disastrous. And that's the main problem with those things. There are also, as I said, plenty of things that didn't survive. But there are some things that do survive, and the government now is a more critical provider of services to people.
$500 billion.
Well, I might just... Yeah,
all right.
And then on the second point, I think there is a difference between how the Rudd government and how the Whitlam government respond to economic crises. I think it's fair to say that the government actions which are a direct response to the global financial crisis are structured to be temporary. That is, the one-off spending in terms of grants to people, the one-off infrastructure spending, that was short-term. It was structured to be temporary, and it did move out of the system. But there were other government commitments which weren't a response to the economic crisis. Tax changes, pension changes, other new social programs that have significant fiscal consequences to which you refer. So I think the two governments respond differently to economic crises, and I think it's fair to say that despite the subsequent fiscal problems of the government, that its direct response to the global financial crisis is successful in maintaining economic growth and doesn't in and of itself create a problem or didn't create a problem for the budget.
One here, one there.
Just as we've got the airport business going on, I remember back in 1973 for the 22nd of September by-election in Parramatta, it was mooted to put an airport up at Galston. And Gough Whitlam had the very charming way of saying to the people, you're going to get it whether you like it or not. Now, we lost the by-election. Is that a bit of an indicator as one of the Whitlam's legacies for subsequent prime ministers?
Would you two like to answer that?
Troy.
Yeah, Troy? Susan? Did you hear the question?
You want to repeat that? I think one of the legacies, I guess, of the Whitlam government is conviction. Is that if you promise something, you follow through on it. And I don't think anybody could argue that Whitlam was a leader of conviction, and the things that he promised, most of those things he promised in that 1972 election policy speech, he implemented. And there's a lot of governments that have come and gone since that have broken plenty of promises and have not lived up to expectations. So one of the key legacies, I think, of Whitlam, and to keep it brief, is that he did follow through on a lot of the things that he promised he would do. And, you know, I read out a shopping list before. These are things that are now woven into the economic, social and constitutional fabric of Australia, and they did it in 3 years. A very quick analogy is Medibank. Now, Medibank was fiercely contested by the opposition, by the medical industry. And yet Whitlam was such a conviction politician that he took it to a double dissolution election. And the opposition, he won that election. He won a mandate to implement Medibank a second time. The opposition still voted against it. They passed it through a double dissolution. And now we have Medicare in place. And it's a part of the bipartisan policy settlement. No government now would ever move back away from universal health care. So the legacy, an important legacy item, is having a conviction for something and fighting for it. And we can see a good comparison with Kevin Rudd on climate change when he had an opportunity to implement his carbon pollution reduction scheme and go to a double dissolution election. When he had a trigger, he squibbed it.
Yes, I don't know who this is for, but do you think that the diminished legacy of Fraser is due to the fact the way he came to power, or the fact that he made such determined efforts to come to power and did nothing with it?
Who would like to answer that? Producers?
I might have a go.
Yes,
at
since you lived through that.
My first period in the Parliament was when Mr. Fraser was the Prime Minister. Look, I think he didn't do very much with it. Now, on my side of politics, we might say, well, that was a good thing because we wouldn't have liked some of the things he wanted to do. But he did, I mean, certainly he came to power in a way that was highly contentious. But once you're there, you're there. We know that in politics. I mean, some people and scholars like to argue about what happened on the day before and so forth, but he was there. And he, for a lot of that time, he had control of the Senate. When I was a new senator, we had this thing where the only way we could interrupt legislation that Malcolm Fraser was determined to get through was by filibustering. So I'd be told, get up and speak for an hour. The standing orders allowed that then. I said, what about, doesn't matter, just sleep. We don't want it to get through tonight. So we did have a lot of opportunity. It seemed, in retrospect, and Gerard, you're the expert on that side of Parliament, of politics, that he actually didn't have a big program that he wanted to implement, because he could have got anything through the Senate. Lost opportunities from his point of view.
Anyone else want to say?
I'll just make a brief point. Yes. Just about Malcolm Fraser, I won't get into a debate with Gerard, we've talked about these things before, and mostly we agree on Fraser. But on the dismissal, Fraser is unapologetic about the dismissal. When I interviewed him, I said, any regrets, any things he would have done differently, and it's none. I quote him in the last piece of the book, the last chapter that I write about the generation that are still left from that Whitlam cabinet and that Whitlam era. And I quote Fraser, and he says, the Whitlam government had great failings, enormous failings, and he was determined to bring them down, and he doesn't regret any single thing that he did in terms of the dismissal. So he may be loved at literary festivals and by bicycle-riding, muesli-chewing, sandal-wearing lefties, but he's unapologetic and unrepentant for every single thing he did on the dismissal.
I agree with Troy, that is true, but in passing he's given a fair bit of gratuitous criticism of John Kerr, who's not alive to defend himself. That's my point.
Over there?
Troy.
Curious about what panelists might think of an observation that perhaps Whitlam's, one of his greatest failings was his inability to select and control the people in his cabinet. If you think about Cairns, Xavier Connor, Al Brasby, I'm sure I'd come up with some others, who were demonstrably incompetent in a very dangerous fashion. And yet he was unable to control them, or unwilling to control them. Which was it?
I'll make a brief comment about that. There's no question. The talent in the Labor caucus was very thin, and there wasn't a lot of people that he could choose from. I note in the book, from talking to Gough and reading from the time, there were a number of ministers he wanted to get in to that ministry, but he couldn't. They had something like 3 or 4 ballots for the ministry over a 6-hour period, and then it took him an hour and a half to allocate the portfolios. It is another world in compiling ministries. Whitlam often said he had his 3 great failings with the 3 C's. Cairns, Connor and Crean, and they were. And, you know, that to me, that just underscores how significant it is what they still did, even though the ministry was shambolic. You know, they were all in cabinet. As John has mentioned, you know, caucus decisions would overturn cabinet decisions. It was a complete mess and a complete joke, most of it. But they still did an enormous amount of stuff, and that's largely, I think, because of Whitlam's determination to do it.
Any other comments? John? Susan?
I wouldn't mind just saying, even if Whitlam had had the rule which Kevin Rudd brought in and Julia Gillard kept, where the leader chooses the cabinet instead of having caucus elections, he wouldn't have avoided all of those people. Remember, Cairns was the hero of the moratorium movement. I mean, Cairns had such huge support, and to this day, I know people who say, "Oh, Cairns should have been Prime Minister." I'm not one of those people who thinks that, by the way. But many do. So I think the idea that, you know, whether you change and say, "Well, the leader chooses," or have a caucus ballot, oversimplifies the process. You have ballots, but even when you don't have ballots, it's very clear that the different groupings within caucus determine to a large extent. So I don't think Whitlam could have escaped the fate that you described.
I just want to make 2 corrective points without pointing this out too negative about the government. The first was that in terms of the people who were involved, they believed a lot of the things that they were doing, so it wasn't as though they were just—they weren't mistakes that they were doing. That is, that they believed in the industrial relations policy they took forward. They thought that minimum wages should be that high. They thought that the public sector should be the pay setter for the economy. They thought that the budget should go into deficit. There were people inside the cabinet who had obviously what we would now describe as being, you know, backward views on the economy. Arthur Gitzel, he wasn't in the cabinet, but his view on industrial relations was that everybody in Australia should be earning above average wages. So
he obviously didn't do well at maths. Is there someone over there? Had you on the aisle? Yeah, Margaret. Is it to anyone?
No, it's just a comment that Malcolm Fraser might not have had any regrets, but certainly my experience of Sir John Kerr was that he did. I'm a professor of law and of medicine at McGill University in Canada, and Sir John came to lecture to the law students, and he was absolutely, totally full of anxiety. I mean, even the law students were astounded by it, and in terms of saying, you know, was it the right thing? Had he done the right thing? And so it was sort of an interesting encounter. Yeah. He appeared to be very nervous, would have been the way
I think that's true. I mean, people, those of us who knew John Kerr, always thought that he constantly sought reassurance for his decision. And Sir Anthony Mason, as I recall, at Sir John's memorial service at a public address, made the same point. But he was also internally convinced that he did do the right thing. So he was after reassurance that he'd done the right thing. He didn't have grave doubts about it, but it was something that was always on his mind. But bear in mind, as you would know, that he took the job as Governor-General believing in the reserve powers. He supported the dismissal of the Labor government by Philip Game in New South Wales in 1932. He thought that was the right decision. And he went down as someone who thought that he might have to use the reserve powers because the government didn't have a very clear majority in the Senate. So, look, I think he was full of those concerns. But underneath it, he thought he did the right thing, and I think that comes out in his papers. But the material that Troy and Paul Kelly and Michael Sexton and Peter Van Onsen have got in this book is, I find, even as someone who knows this topic well, I find it very interesting to read.
We'll let Troy sum up. I'd like Troy to sum up that, and also just give us some idea of the scope of this book, because it's an incredible collection, and there are copies down the back, and it might be good if you just give us a little summary of how broad it is.
Sure. Look, just on John Kerr, it's a really good point you make, and there's no doubt in my mind that he was plagued, I think, with this sense of wanting reassurance for his actions. And as I mentioned earlier, Paul Kelly and I spent 2 days going through his files. He kept a diary that he started, I think, in 1980 briefly. He's constantly going back over events. He's constantly writing about them. He's writing notes. He goes on a holiday to Paris and there's, you know, a hotel letterhead. And he's again writing for the fifth time about one meeting he had with Gough Whitlam and who said what and whatever, you know, 10 years afterwards. He sought out Anthony Mason as early as August, September, for his advice. They had many, many discussions. He obviously sought out Garfield Barwick, and we reveal in the book additional conversations. He rings Garfield Barwick on the morning of the dismissal to ask how he should handle Whitlam when they come face to face. When the Speaker is at the gate of at the Government House at Yarralumla with the resolution of the House passing no confidence in Malcolm Fraser, what does he do? He rings Anthony Mason and says, "What do I do?" So he was, as Fraser says, a weak man, and he needed reassurance. He wasn't uncertain in his decision to dismiss the government. I think I agree with that with Jared. He was concerned about the government. He was convinced it was the right course of action, and he had the legal authority to do so. But he was seeking this reassurance, and you can see it also all the way through. The other document we found is one called what he describes an arch of opinion. And he lists all the people that he relies on because he didn't trust the government's chief law officers, Maurice Byers or Clarence Harders. So he looked at some of these other people, like Bob Ellicott. He relied on the advice that Ellicott had given Fraser and Mason and Barwick and others. And he even writes a lot about Doc Evatt, who, of course, had written the textbook on the reserve powers, and he was a patron of Kerr as a young man living in Balmain. So, you know, he is tortured by these things, and he's always looking for other people to buffer him up.
Okay.
Oh, the book. It is now time, everybody, to buy the book.
It's a little guide to.
I think it's an authoritative collection of every aspect of the Whitlam government, the personalities, the political events, all the policy issues are covered by academics, people who were there. Some of the ministers, like Moss Cass and Kep Enderby, have written for the book, and Bill Morrison. Gough Whitlam has written the foreword. It's the last public statement Gough Whitlam will ever make. Bob Carr, Michael Kirby, a whole bunch of people, you know, very eminent scholars, and Graham Frydenberg, who was there, Eric Walsh, who was his press secretary, who hasn't written about this stuff before, and Evan Williams, who was also a press secretary, he hasn't written about this stuff before. So it's an inside look at the government. Everything's covered. It's not a whitewash, and it's a great Christmas present.
That's it, and thank you to Troy and Susan and John and Jared. Copies down the back, limited copies. I'm sure they'll sign it for you. And if we get orders that come in, maybe we can pop into the office and we'll sell some online. But thanks for coming, and a great night. Happy Christmas, everybody.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.